You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 15th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up.
Это хорошо понимают жители Донбасса и Новороссии, которые в тяжелейших условиях.
We preview this weekend's elections in Russia with Vladimir Putin certain to retain the presidency. We'll examine why the country is going to the polls and the long-term prospects under Putin. Also ahead in the next 60 minutes, how Japan could be key to bolstering military support for Kyiv, albeit indirectly. We'll examine what form the Netherlands' new government could take after the far-right populist Geert Wilders says he's not got enough support to be the country's next prime minister. And we'll go through the newspapers and we'll enjoy an alternative look at the week's news, courtesy of Andrew Muller.
We, for one humorous news monologue, are, as we look ahead to the next 8 months, hoping Kennedy picks Rogers, as all the jokes one can make about Ventura are already pretty much pre-assigned to another presidential candidate.
That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London with me, Emma Nelson. So a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Hamas has presented a plan for a ceasefire in Gaza, which includes the release of Israeli hostages in exchange for the release of up to 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. South Korea is to hold a democracy summit next week, taking up a US-led initiative aimed at stopping the erosion of human rights and freedoms worldwide. And the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz will host his French and Polish counterparts in Berlin later today in a show of European unity in support for Ukraine. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, barring a major disruption this weekend, Vladimir Putin will be re-elected as Russia's president. The polls have opened and they close on Sunday, guaranteeing President Putin another six-year term in the Kremlin, cementing his tenure until at least 2030. Opposition figures who could have challenged him are either in prison or exiled, or in the case of Alexei Navalny, dead. Any media that could show criticism of him have been blocked. Well, to tell us more about the events this weekend, I'm joined now by Jenny Mathers, who's Senior Lecturer in International Politics at Aberystwyth University. A very good morning. Welcome back, Jenny.
Thank you. Good morning.
On paper, what is the purpose of this election?
So the purpose of the election is really to demonstrate the legitimacy of Putin's continued rule in Russia, effectively. And also it's being used by Putin very explicitly as a referendum on the extent of support in Russia for the war in Ukraine. So, you know, constitutionally, there's a requirement for the president to be reelected every 6 years or a president to be elected every 6 years. But the real purposes, I think, are definitely these more sort of subtle purposes in terms of legitimacy and also demonstrating that, you know, the country is behind Putin come what may.
It's funny that you use the word subtlety. And I mean, that's not something that you would necessarily associate with the reelection once again of Vladimir Putin.
Yes, I suppose that's true. But I mean, in some respects, it's a very blatant power grab. But in others, it is presented as just part of everyday life. So, you know, many of the Russians who have been interviewed by Western media in the run-up to these elections have, you know, expressed that, well, of course, we'll vote for Putin. Who else is there? You know, he's our leader. We believe in him. We're on the right path. Of course, you know, this is just something that happens. So it's taken this this position as just an everyday part of life that you don't really think about too much. You just go and do it and then carry on.
I mean, you say this is just part of everyday life, but the Kremlin has reportedly spent more than €1 billion on campaigning and promoting Putin in the lead up to the election. I mean, why would they feel the need to do this, not least if the re-election of Putin is guaranteed, but also in the middle of war?
Well, I think what Putin has often put a lot of emphasis on throughout his presidencies, multiple terms, is unity, the unity of society. And it's really important for him to demonstrate again and again and again that Russian society is behind him. Russian society is unified in its purpose of supporting his regime in its various endeavors, and now, more importantly, in supporting the war in Ukraine. So this need, this sort of craving for a demonstration of legitimacy and unity obviously runs very deep, because, as you say, there are many other pressing priorities for spending money at the moment in Russia. But the election campaign is sort of pushed its way to the forefront. And this is what the Kremlin is focused on at the moment.
And you mentioned there the idea of unity and pushing things to the forefront. But will this exercise in voting stir up the patriotism and renewable, you know, the reemergence of Russia's tolerance of the war against Ukraine, because there is need for active support for the Russian invasion of Ukraine, not just tolerance now, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, men have to be willing to respond to the mobilization orders, or they have to be willing to volunteer in some cases in order to keep that war going. And so the active participation of citizens in the shape of soldiers, but also in the shape of their families, who will then pick up an enormous burden of all kinds of, you know, financial, material, emotional, in supporting those men as they're fighting and if they die in the war. You know, it's a huge burden on society, but it does require not just turning the other cheek and looking away, but actually actively supporting it from substantial parts of the population. Although I would say so far the war has not touched the major cities in the way that it's touched the regions and the more rural areas.
And tell us a little bit more about how strong, I mean, you mentioned just there the fact that the way that the war hasn't touched the cities, but it has touched areas outside cities where more soldiers will be sent off to war and the gaps will be felt more strongly. But how strong is the sense of patriotism in Russia at the moment? I mean, the reports that we're seeing at the moment, when you see Russians on the television saying, you know, I'm voting for Putin, he is the only man who can secure our future. How genuine is that? There is a sense that there is still a lot of affection for him, isn't there?
Well, I think he's benefited from a number of factors. One is this residual sense that he brought them a greater prosperity. And that was certainly more true in his earlier terms as president than presently. But nevertheless, you know, brought Russia stability in terms of politics, brought it prosperity in terms of the economy, and also brought it prestige in the world. And is always contrasted, and he contrasts himself with Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s, when none of those things were true. And so he's still riding to a certain extent on that reputation. I think also he's played very strongly the hand about, you know, Russia being sort of beleaguered and besieged by the West, and, you know, standing for important family and traditional values and so on. So, you know, he benefits from a number of things, including the fact that he has ruthlessly eliminated his rivals. That also helps to be seen as the only man who can do the job if you have carefully removed all the other possibilities from the running.
You mentioned there the issue of the West. I mean, how much does that factor in the elections this year? There's a report, there's a comment from one of Putin's close allies, unnamed, in Reuters this morning, saying Putin has no competitors. He's at a completely different level because the West made a very serious mistake by helping to unify a large part of the Russian elite and the Russian population around Putin with its sanctions and vilifications of Russia. Is the West seen as one of the great perpetrators and threats of Russia publicly still?
That is certainly the narrative of the Kremlin. And it's very noticeable that in terms of the rhetoric around the war in Ukraine, that it's often depicted as a war against the West rather than as a war against just Ukraine. So, yes, I think to a large extent, the sanctions and so on have caused people to sort of rally around the flag. Those who are not very adamantly opposed to the war and very skeptical of what Putin is doing. So yes, it does tend to have that sort of a patriotic, nationalistic effect, which we are seeing in Russia to some extent.
And there is no opposition, is there? I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning, if you stand up to Putin, you're either in prison, in exile, or in the case of Alexei Navalny, you're dead.
Yes, well, there are three other men running against Putin in this election, but they are very much the usual suspects. They're, you know, leaders of political parties that are represented in the Duma. They are people who give the illusion of choice, right? So there's no real opposition to Putin in this election, although it is worth pointing out that Yulia Navalnaya, Navalny's widow, has called for political action at the polling stations on Sunday. So we'll see whether people actually rally to that cause.
Indeed. I mean, there are suggestions that people are being encouraged to do things on their ballot papers in an effort to give this to Alexei Navalny as a sort of a last comment or a last stand from the grave?
I think, yes, to some extent, yes. I think his widow is using his memory very strongly, and this is something, you know, this sort of action is something that he himself called for before he was killed. I think, but nevertheless, it's also an effort to give civil society in Russia a little bit of hope, to give those people who are dissatisfied with Putin, whether mildly or strongly, an opportunity to do something which is relatively low risk. So spoiling your ballot paper is relatively low risk, or turning up at the polling stations at 12 noon on Sunday, which is what she's called for, even simply to stand silently in vigil for half an hour. That should be relatively low risk because people are supposed to vote. So the regime wants people to go to the polling stations. So it's a way of demonstrating that there is a strength of feeling against the regime. It's a way for people who have that feeling to see that there are others who share their views and to maybe begin rebuilding civil society in Russia one step at a time.
The final question is a long-term prospect for Russia and indeed how history will view this period in time. Because by the time Putin reaches his next milestone in 2030, he will have been in power longer than Stalin. Stalin made, I think he's 29 years in power, and by the time that we get to 2030, Putin will have been in power for, 31 years. Where will this sit in Russia's history?
Well, it sort of depends on what happens afterwards, doesn't it? Because you know, if Russia continues on in a similar path after Putin, then it might be written in the history books of those who control the country as, you know, an important step towards a glorious past, you know, glorious future. If, however, things take a different turn, then it will probably be seen as quite a dark period of increasing state control and, you know, lack of opportunities for ordinary people to really express themselves in any meaningful way in politics.
Jenny Mathers, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. Now, could Japan be the key to helping the US in its support for Ukraine? There are reports that Washington is working on a plan to extract more military help from Tokyo. The work is being carried out ahead of a visit to the White House by Japan's Prime Minister next month. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by James D. Brown, who's Professor of International Affairs at Temple University's Japan campus. A very good afternoon to you, James.
Hello.
So just explain to us, what details do we have of this plan?
Well, I wouldn't say as yet it's really a plan. It's rather the start of a negotiation. What we've had so far is that Japan has shown that it is very much willing to support Ukraine financially and with humanitarian aid. But so far, it's done really quite little within the military area. And so that's going to be the subject of the talks between the United States and Japan, with the White House seeking to encourage Japan to do more in that area.
So what could Japan offer in terms of military aid?
Well, maybe a starting point is to look at what they've done so far. So in terms of military aid, they've only so far provided 0.06 billion euros. And that's actually all non-lethal. So they're providing things like bulletproof vests, protective clothing, masks, and they've promised a few vehicles stripped of their weaponry. So that's really all they've done so far. And what I think the US is especially interested in is, well, ideally that Japan would actually provide weapons, but if failing that, they could at least play a backfilling role. So what I mean by that is that Japan would provide weapons to the United States, which would then free up resources for the US to provide more arms to Ukraine.
Why has the United States decided to ask Japan in particular for this kind of help?
Well, I mean, a lot of it has to do with the political gridlock within the United States, if that is meaning that it's holding up supplies of more military aid to Ukraine, then the US has to look elsewhere. Now, Clearly, it can look to NATO partners, but most of those countries are already doing just about everything that they can. So as the US scans the its partners, its allies, its eye has fallen upon Japan as a country that could do more. After all, Japan has really quite a capable self-defense force. It has its own arms industry, but so far isn't really providing any military equipment to Ukraine.
How's Japan reacted to all this? Because, I mean, when you read in a little bit, there are reports and the word that keeps coming up is that Japan is being dragged into a deeper involvement in the conflict in Ukraine. I mean, how correct an assessment is that?
Well, of course, as in any country, the views in Japan are not monolithic, but there are many within the country, including within the political system, that are very hesitant about stepping away from Japan's traditional pacifist position. And in particular, you have this party, which is part of the ruling coalition, which is called Kōmeitō. And that's a Buddhist party. And they're relatively small. They tend to receive only about 12% of the vote share. But they're in coalition with the main party, the Liberal Democrats. And they really want to put the brakes on. They feel that it is not appropriate for Japan to provide anything more than really financial support for Ukraine. And so that's really holding things up.
This becomes an existential issue for Japan more than it becomes a problem for the United States then?
Well, when you talk about existential issues, I think that's right, because what the supporters of doing more for Ukraine would argue is that this isn't a distant security problem that only affects Europe. This is really about Japan's own security, because Japan is thinking about future potential crises. What supporters of more assistance for Ukraine are thinking is that if Japan's not willing to do more to help with European security, then in the case of a real crisis in East Asia, such as if China were to attack Taiwan and that were to lead to a war involving Japan as well, well, then the concern would be that if Japan hasn't done its bit, then European allies won't support Japan in those circumstances.
Because there is the sense, isn't there, that Japan will be doing all the giving at this point, and it will be changing quite fundamental approaches to its military involvement globally. One wonders what Tokyo can expect in return for this help.
Yes, well, I suppose in the short term, it would be very much the assistance going from Japan to Ukraine. But as I say, those who support doing more make the argument that if Japan thinks about the future, then it could be a very different situation. There are also those who believe that Japan's pacifism has really served its purpose. It's a long time since the Second World War. Japan, for those who take this view, feel that it should throw off the shackles of the past and adopt a more normal role similar to that taken by the UK.
James D. Brown, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Tokyo. Still to come on today's programme, we'll enjoy Andrew Muller's look back at the week and...
I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco and I'll be speaking from São Paulo. We talk about the city's design week and Max is exploring the world of telenovelas.
Stay tuned to The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is a political reporter, Vincent McAvinny. Hello, Vinny.
Good morning.
How's life in the McAvinny world?
Good. I'm on holiday tomorrow, so all good.
Where are
you
going?
And it's sunny in London this morning.
And you're leaving.
Yeah, I know, but it feels like spring might be on its way.
So you're going up a mountain.
Yeah, so I'm going somewhere cold and snowy.
Excellent. Yeah. Lovely. Come back in one piece, please. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Now we've had, let's talk about an article in the New York Times, which follows some quite astonishing comments being made by Chuck Schumer in the United States yesterday, in terms of a direct assault on the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah, and of course, that's, you know, preface with his position. He is the top Senate Democrat. He is the highest ranking Jewish elected official in the United States. And he has spoken from the floor of the Senate to talk about the war, talk about anti-Semitism, but also to condemn quite strongly Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and call for elections to replace him. In his remarks, he said that, you know, echoed President Biden's words that the Israeli military offensive under Netanyahu has been over the top, that he is jeopardizing the security of Israel again, having let it lapse on October the 7th. By making it almost a pariah state and cutting off support for it around the world, which creates an even greater existential danger. And he is saying that really it is time now for an election. That's had a strong rebuttal from Republicans. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, saying the comments were grotesque and hypocritical for Americans who, quote, hyperventilate about foreign interference in our own democracy to call for the removal of the democratically elected leader of Israel. And he said the move had been unprecedented. But when you look at the feeling towards Benjamin Netanyahu around the world, and particularly in America, even those that support Israel are very critical of the path that he has taken. Many obviously believe that he is simply doing anything possible now to stay in power, given the legal jeopardy that he faces should he be removed.
It's an interesting path that Chuck Schumer is taking here, because he is individually singling out Benjamin Netanyahu as the problem, as opposed to Israel's conduct generally in Gaza. And it therefore causes all manner of problems in terms of division in the United States. And this article in the New York Times talks about the fact that, you know, the Democratic Party doesn't have an anti-Bibi problem, says Senator Mitch McConnell, the minority leader. He says he has an anti-Israel problem. You're looking at America trying to work out where it can actually criticize Israel or where it actually stands on the Gaza issue.
Yeah, and Mr. Schumer, you know, represents a state with more than 20% of the country's Jewish population, and he was careful to assert that he was not trying to dictate any electoral outcomes. And he prefaced all the criticism of Netanyahu with a sort of long defense of Israel, which he said American Jews, quote, loved in their bones. But what he thinks is happening is that there is, in some quarters in America, inaccurate perceptions of the war, particularly Democrats amongst their own voters, particularly young people who are getting their news through the prism of TikTok. And they've been slightly taken aback at the fact that there's been such sort of strong support for the Palestinians, and particularly people even sort of, you know, apologizing or sort of being seemingly okay with Hamas and not really understanding the situation. And so in his remarks, he is very careful to sort of, you know, preface it so that he can't be attacked for being anti-Israel. But he does seem to sort of tap into a general feeling across political divides that it is probably time for Benjamin Netanyahu to go. But there is peril in that as well, given the Republican attacks. But yeah, it does show that this is going to become an election issue. And it's no secret that Benjamin Netanyahu would probably much prefer for Donald Trump to be in office, that he can run rings around him. And it's in his interest, not only for his own position, but for the election to keep this conflict somewhat going. Whereas the Democrats would be pretty happy if it wrapped up and there was a ceasefire as soon as possible, because they don't want it to jeopardize Joe Biden's re-election chances.
Let's move on to a story in The Times, an absolutely brilliantly interesting story about the CIA, Donald Trump, and the Chinese.
Yes, this is a really interesting story. It's back in 2018, and it effectively purports that Donald Trump gave authorization to the CIA to try a campaign to undermine President Xi's authority by deploying bogus social media accounts to promote corruption claims involving senior officials in Beijing and to plant those stories in media outlets around the world. And Donald Trump apparently approved it after the intelligence services were worried that Russia and China had meddled in the 2016 election. And it really harks back to the tactics used against the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And officials at the time were apparently saying that China and Russia are playing with steel baseball bats and we're trying to hit them back with wooden ones. We need to get tougher. So some of the things that are alleged to have happened revolve around the sort of much heralded Belt and Road operation that China has around the world, where they go into countries and they're building infrastructure and ports and roads and trains and all these things. And the stories that have been planted to try and undermine Chinese authority is that Chinese officials have been siphoning off money from these projects. They have been tampering with the contracts. They've been getting the money and not sort of bringing it back to China, but siphoning it off and taking it to offshore bank accounts that they hold, and that there is corruption there. Obviously, very damaging accusations for Chinese officials. And it really does feel like a sort of Cold War tactic. It's unclear whether or not the CIA operation has continued under Joe Biden. They've obviously declined to comment on this, but it really does harken back to a different time.
It was an interesting line, isn't it, in the Times says. It's unclear how effective the CIA operation was and actually whether it continues, but it just shows that
particularly
everybody's
when,
doing it.
Yeah, particularly when, you know, a lot of talk this week, the US has banned, you know, sort of China's tried to sort of really pontificate on attacking the US, you know, saying you're not a free society, you're banning our TikTok app because you're demanding the sale of it by ByteDance. Well, equally, no Western social media at all is active in China. They have, you know, domestic, heavily controlled services. They have a sort of walled-off internet. So it's a bit rich for China to be making those accusations. But whether or not these stories manage to get back into the sort of Chinese domain, given the level of control that they have, much more than the Soviet Union had in the 1980s, then it's sort of remains to see how successful this has been.
Let's look at a sort of brilliant story in the New York Times. The New York Times is very good at this kind of stuff. It does a sort of an assessment. It takes the temperature of various things across America. And this is an interesting tale of real estate. The fact that there is a significant drop in real estate prices in cities in America at the moment. And as a result, the amount of cash that cities are getting from taxes is dropping.
Yeah, that's right. It gives examples in this piece of several buildings. So in San Francisco, a 20-story office tower that was sold for $146 million a decade ago was listed in December for just $80 million. In Chicago, the same, a 200,000-square-foot office building that was sold in 2004, all the way back then, for nearly $90 million. Well, it was purchased last month for $20 million. I mean, you're getting these bargain basement discounts on real estate properties around the US. And obviously there is a hit because of hybrid working. But the piece talked about what is a sort of a doom loop, where you've essentially got less footfall in cities because there is more people working from home, which then means that you are having businesses collapse and go under, particularly service businesses, food, all those kinds of places. It then makes it a less desirable place to go, which means that people tend to spend more time working from home than coming into the office. Companies think we need to downsize the offices. That means that they're selling up. They're paying less in local taxes because they're taking smaller spaces or moving spaces outside of the city centre. And then that means that there's less services. And so you're seeing this sort of explosion again in US cities, particularly, you know, we've seen incidences in the likes of Portland and San Francisco, where they're becoming sort of, you know, depression era like ghost towns where there is high crime. You've got sort of these huge scale homeless encampments popping up. And it's, you could see that it is going to be a very difficult time for cities to recover. There is also, of course, then whether or not this is building up a huge commercial real estate sort of fault line akin to the sort of subprime mortgage crisis in 2007-2008, because, you know, whether these banks are now falling, or the buildings, apologies, are falling into negative equity in the banks, you know, that could create massive problems in the system that we might not be seeing it like 2008. It's a bit like, you know, a snake swallowing a rabbit. You sort of see this lump sort of moving down the system and then it becomes a real problem at the end.
And it's going to be affecting different countries. And it's quite strange. I was coming in early this morning, and Friday mornings in London are normally absolutely deathly quiet.
It used to be really hard to drive out of London on a Friday evening because that would be the time people, you know, getting out of the city. Now that doesn't really happen as much.
It felt more busy this morning for the first time. I wondered whether we were actually coming back to something a little bit more balanced, but we shall see. Finally, The Guardian is reporting that Let's have a bit of background in this. There is a system in the centre of London which prohibits the use of various polluting vehicles to come into the city of the centre of the city, because for obvious reasons you don't want a highly polluting car in a highly built up area.
And these are cars sort of pre-2004. They are pretty old these days. I think it's the Euro 6 standard they fail to meet.
So what to do with them? They want to send them to Ukraine.
Yeah, so it's called ULEZ. It effectively operates, there's a sort of motorway that rings the London called the M25. It effectively operates in the entirety of that zone. You have to pay something like, I think it's £20 a day or something, to be able to drive this car in the ULEZ zone. So it has caused huge problems in the capital for the mayor, Sadiq Khan. It's obviously clearing up the air, and you know, London has quite an issue with air quality. It wants to improve it. That's something the vast majority of Londoners agree with. But there are some people, tradespeople obviously in particular, who need vans. Those tend to be older, and so they've had to sort of do various schemes to help those businesses sort of stay afloat, to change over to more compliant and greener vehicles. But one thing that was mooted last year in this sort of ground campaign was, well, is there a system where we could, rather than just scrapping them and getting, you know, there was a small amount of money for commercial operators to get the money back, you know, leave the money, could you give this vehicle to Ukraine? And this, there was a scheme set up with, you know, they asked the Ukrainians, were they interested? Vitaly Klitschko, the Kyiv mayor, said he definitely was, that they would take these vehicles and that they could use them. The piece is interesting though, because it says it doesn't seem to be that much of an issue with having insufficient just normal vehicles in Ukraine. But it's after a little bit of tussling back and forth legally as to whether or not the city hall thought it didn't have the sort of legal powers in order to do this scheme, the government's now pushed it through. And so people will be able to donate their old vehicles, particularly, of course, an example's given here of old SUVs, which are particularly bad when it comes to sort of the ULEZ charges. Those will be given to Ukraine, and it's hoped that they can be used on the front line for transporting all sorts of things.
Thank you very much indeed, Vincent McAvinney, for joining us in the studio. The time here in London is 7:31 a.m. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A look now at the rest of today's news. Hamas has presented a plan for a ceasefire in Gaza, which includes a release of Israeli hostages in exchange for the release of up to 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. The proposal, which has been given to mediators, says a date for a permanent ceasefire will be agreed after the initial hostage exchange. Israel hasn't commented. South Korea is to hold a democracy summit next week, taking up a US-led initiative aimed at stopping the erosion of human rights and freedoms worldwide. The timing of the summit is partially to coincide with the number of elections being held in 2024. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz will host his French and Polish counterparts in Berlin later today in a show of European unity in support for Ukraine. There have been weeks of friction between France and Germany after President Emmanuel Macron's refusal to rule out deploying Western troops to Ukraine. And France's president has awarded the country's highest honour to the CEO of LVMH. Bernard Arnault, who's the world's richest man, was promoted to Grand Cross of the Legion of Honour at a ceremony at the Élysée Palace. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, after that, let's take an alternative look at the news. Here's Andrew Muller with what we learned.
We learned this week of the single greatest technological innovation of the 21st century, certainly, of all of human history, possibly. So there was that. We learned that a genius in Argentina, an Argentinius, if you will, had developed a machine which turns this into this. We learned that our hero, one Ronnie Bandini, had grown understandably weary of his neighbour's habit of starting the day with window-rattling, deafening salvos of this. This being the unrelaxing Central American hybrid of reggae, dancehall and hip-hop, which has come to be known as reggaeton by its fans and by other names by its fans' neighbours. At least one of those names, an eerily precise rhyme for flat ducking packet. Righto, idea got. But we learned that where most reasonable people would merely have burned their neighbour's house down and thrown themselves confidently upon the mercy of a jury, Bandini built an AI-enabled device which detects and blocks Bluetooth speakers conveying reggaeton. We learned that the device is called Reggaeton Be Gone, and while we have not as yet learned of any plans to develop a portable variant which has the same silencing effect on phones playing audio out loud on trains, ideally while administering an educative electric shock to the operators of said phones, we are choosing to live in hope. Moving swiftly off the subject of living in hope, however, we learned that this year's US presidential election may end up over-catering to that hefty constituency of American voters who believe nothing they read in newspapers and everything they read on the internet. We learned that this guy is apparently serious about staging a third-party run.
My policy is not going to interfere with anybody who wants to take a vaccine.
Some of his views led four prominent members of his own family to say he does not share the same values as their father.
This guy being Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who at a mere 70 years old is clearly hoping to hoover up the youth vote this November. We learned that Kennedy, who is the son of this guy,
seems to me that now as ever, we must measure ourselves against the ancient test of Sophocles. And he said, all men make mistakes, but a good man yields when he knows his course is wrong, and then he repairs the error.
And the nephew of this guy.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Is, as of this broadcast, pondering his choice of putative vice president, which reports suggest he has narrowed down to either this guy.
To be paying, I think it's time for a revolt in this country. I've been advocating a revolution for years now.
I.e. former professional wrestler and Minnesota governor Jesse Ventura, or this guy.
Third and five. Rodgers over the middle, and it's intercepted!
I.e. incumbent New York Jets quarterback and increasingly odd doer of his own research, Aaron Rodgers. We, for one humorous news monologue, are, as we look ahead to the next 8 months, hoping Kennedy picks Rodgers, as all the jokes one can make about Ventura, which is to say all the jokes at the expense of a professional carnival barker ill-deservedly elevated to high public office by an electorate unable or unwilling to distinguish between politics and entertainment, are already pretty much pre-assigned to another presidential candidate.
And then they have cans of soup. Soup.
Whereas, if RFK2 goes with the quarterback of the New York actual Jets, then the bait-and-switch gags pretty much write themselves, about Aaron Rodgers wasting the last years of a fine football career on such an absurd folly, this headlong tilt at a windmill, absolutely certain to end in calamity and humiliation, while also, yes, running as Robert Kennedy Jr.'s vice president. A big hello to all our New York Jets fans listeners. Or conceivably, a big goodbye. And
if I could save time in a bottle.
We learned that stuffing a message into a bottle. And yes, we know there is a much more obvious song we could be playing underneath this bit about a message in a bottle, but the Police just always absolutely sucked, like possibly the most annoying band of the post-punk era who weren't Talking Heads. Can I get some general muttered agreement? We learned that stuffing a message into a bottle and flinging it into the ocean was not necessarily the swiftest or most efficient means of communication. Indeed, our own socks were not exactly knocked off by this revelation either, but we now have empirical evidence. We learned it from the labours of a public-spirited volunteer who, clearing up litter on a beach in Scotland, specifically on the Tay Estuary, found a bottle containing what appeared to be some sort of document. Upon removing what we are going to go ahead and imagine was a stopper, she found a map, which she unfolded. Liquid sound effects this week, which she unfolded to discover messages from three primary school children complaining about being made to do maths. We learned, however, that the messages had been sent in 1984, which, if the idle brats had been paying attention in maths, they would know was 40 years ago, and from a school barely 10 kilometres from where their letter was found. We will at this time leave it to our British listeners to do their own jokes about how this is still quicker than a particular parcel delivery company who our lawyer tells us we cannot name. Come in off the ledge, Lionel. We've deleted it. For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you, Andrew. You're listening to The Globalist. ...8:40 in Amsterdam, 7:40 here in London. Now, the Netherlands is still searching for a new prime minister. After the last election, which was back in November, the party with the most seats was the Anti-Immigration Freedom Party, led by Geert Wilders. He wanted the top job, the prime ministership, and he's been trying to find coalition partners to make that work. But on Wednesday, he had to concede that that is not going to happen. Well, Stijn van Kessel is Associate Professor of European Politics at Queen Mary University of London. I'm delighted to say he joins me in the studio. Very good morning to you, Stijn.
Good morning.
Could you just update us on events since November's election? A hard question to answer.
Yeah, so it's about 115 days ago, I think. And in the meantime, the progress with negotiation talks to form a new government have been very bumpy. The first round of so-called information has not been a success, with especially Pieter Omtzigt, the leader of the new centrist party. He broke away from the Christian Democrats, forming a new party that focused mainly on good governance and a better relationship between the government and the people. He's kind of the kingmaker. He won quite a lot of seats. So he was most reluctant, and he sort of walked away from the negotiation table, whereas the other parties were more willing to form a government with Geert Wilders. That includes the Liberal Conservative VVD, that's the party of the outgoing Prime Minister Mark Rutte, and the Farmers Agrarian Party, that's also a new upstart. But somehow Omtzigt was tempted back to the negotiation table. So the second round of talks have been more successful, but they've only been about the format of the government rather than the substance. So we still don't know whether this attempt will actually succeed.
And the format is the bit where it gets really quite complicated, isn't it? I mean, from the outside, most of us have been very used to total stability and common sense and straightforward thinking with Mark Rutte in power for a very, very long time. That's now all changing, isn't it? Because you have in the Netherlands the introduction of a so-called extra-parliamentary cabinet. What is that?
No one really knows. So, the key elements seem to be that the party leaders won't take part in cabinet. So the difference between Netherlands and UK, for instance, is that members of the cabinet can't be sitting in parliament. So there's at least in theory more dualism or a stricter separation of powers. So that is one element. Another presumed element is that the cabinet will consist of members outside of the party elite, so people with so to say more distance from party
politics. Not necessarily politicians,
but it remains really to be seen whether that will play out in practice.
So does this mean that while they're running this extra parliamentary cabinet, they can actually call anybody in to lead while they try and work out what's going on?
Yeah, according to the Dutch constitution, that's possible anyway. So you can get outsiders, so to speak, to fill ministerial posts. They don't have to be MPs or politicians. So the idea is that what the informateur, so the person that sort of looked at the possibilities of coalition formation, Kim Putters, he argued that it should be about 50-50, so 50% politicians and 50% outsiders. But it really remains to be seen whether that will happen in practice.
What did the Dutch make of all this?
They're probably a bit confused. I mean, they're clearly also divided because, Geert Wilders won a lot of votes, 25% of the vote, but clearly there are also a lot of people who didn't vote for Wilders, so they're very divided on what is happening now. Interestingly, people who voted for right-wing parties, so also the presumed collaborators of Wilders in office, they all support the government, or all support, the majority of them support the government with Wilders because they sort of naturally think that he has the right to form a government, being the largest party, and that's also how it's been framed in the campaign, really. Clearly, a lot of the people are very opposed to a government.
I mean, Wilders a couple of days ago said that he couldn't make himself prime minister because he couldn't get enough support. So there's this big contradiction now, isn't there, that the issue is that Geert Wilders enjoys public popularity, yet is wildly unpopular within the political world, isn't it? So how does that resolve itself?
Well, again, it's a polarizing figure. 25% of the people voted for him, but there's a lot of people who dislike Wilders also. His fellow coalition partners or perhaps coalition partners are worried that they'll lose kind of the blame game if this government doesn't last very long, which is quite likely because everything we see is a recipe for instability. So strategically, they try to position themselves not too close to Wilders. They want to show that they're not completely following the tracks of the radical right.
Isn't this something sort of what the Dutch population actually slightly wished for? Because when they went to the polls, I mean, you've mentioned the several very strong-minded political players and political parties that all want to have a share of the power. But, there is criticism that Mark Rutte actually sort of depoliticized Dutch politics by making sure that everybody could work together and making sure that everything could happen.
Yeah, and the outgoing government was very much a grand coalition between four parties. And what research also shows is that if you have these governments, it's more likely to lead to the success of parties on the fringes that can say, well, the government, they're all thinking the same. All the other politicians, they don't really provide a choice to the voters. So, yeah, these grand coalitions are a recipe for the growth of fringe parties.
Stijn van Kessel, thank you so much for joining us in the studio on The Globalist. You're listening to Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Talk about theatre. Matt Wolfe is already talking about theatre. Hello, how are you?
It takes a lot to stop me. How are you, Emma?
I'm very well, thank you. Right. Okay, here we go. To another lively few minutes. Yes. Tell us about what's happening in the world of theatre, Matt Wolfe.
Well, there are a lot of shows about the NHS. It's funny how, like the London buses, things come in threes or more. And there have been three shows opening in the last month or so, all on the topic of the NHS. I guess that's a hot button topic in an election year. These three shows could not be more different. One of them is finished. And in fact, it was in some ways my favorite of the bunch. It was at the Bush Theatre called This Might Not Be It. But there are two others that are a real compare and contrast. One is at the Donmar by Lucy Kirkwood. It's called The Human Body, and that is really marked out by a resplendent performance from Keeley Hawes, an actress who doesn't do enough theater, and she's got an absolutely luminous natural stage presence. And she plays a Shropshire GP in 1948 with parliamentary aspirations, which of course bumps up against the formation of the NHS. But if you really want to know how the NHS was formed, you could go to the National Theater to see Rufus Norris's epic production of Nye, N-Y-E, which of course refers to Aniran Bevan, the architect of the NHS, except that the odd thing about Nye is that you really only hear about the NHS in sort of the last stretch of a three-hour production. And up until then, you get a lot of, interesting...
Sweets and biscuits.
Yeah.
And just eat you them
get,
instead.
You get hustle and bustle about his background and his vexed relationship with his father and, you know, party politics in rural Wales. And that's all very interesting.
You sound a bit wary.
But the kind of nub of it takes a long time to come into focus.
I mean, one wonders, we are, what, 3 years since we sort of emerged from the pandemic
right
now. And one wonders, is that the sort of natural incubation time for a good play about something?
I think yes, and I think also there's a real desire on the part of a lot of these theatres, and Nye's a good example of this, to throw all the resources they can at a production and go big, because during the pandemic we had to go small. So the NHS, of course, is a huge entity and they can have a big production to tackle it. It doesn't quite succeed, but Michael Sheen certainly gives it his all, as Keeley Hawes does in the other one. So whatever you think of the plays, you get some stonking star performances.
And just, I mean, from your point of view, as you know, the critic for the New York Times, how do you then say to the New York Times, London's gone mad for the health service?
Well, you know, healthcare in America is a pretty vexed issue itself in other ways. So I think people are interested in seeing what systems are in place and how they are represented to the general public. And of course, there have been plays about the NHS across the years. There was a famous one years ago by Peter Nichols called The National Health. So this isn't new, but it's coming back into focus.
Oh, and how sensible an idea is it to have three different plays about the same subject in a city at any given time? I mean, one wonders whether there's someone ever, people actually ever sit down together and say, well, we're doing this week, so maybe you should wait till next time.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I suspect that doesn't happen, but one of the very good things about the British play-going audience is that people seem to thrive on the compare and contrast aspect of it, whereas in New York, you say, I don't want to see that. I saw a similar thing last month or even last year. Here it's like, oh, well, let's see what positions A, B, and C all offer on the same topic, and then they can decide for themselves.
And if you're being a New Yorker and you're only choosing A, B, or C, which one of the three NHS plays are you going to allocate
your time
for? Well,
the Bush one was great, but that's finished. So I would go for The Human Body, just because seeing Keeley Hawes on stage is such a treat.
She is amazing. Right, Olivier Award nominations.
Well, you know, I'm an awards groupie. I think there should be awards for the best awards. And the Oliviers are always a lot of fun. They're deeply weird and eccentric. You think, how the hell did that get in there? But then other times you go, oh, that makes perfect sense. They're being announced on April 14th. And what's interesting this year for people who love musicals, as I do, is that there are continual categories where the revival of Sunset Boulevard, with Nicole Scherzinger going to Broadway, is bumping up against the Bridge Theatre revival of Guys and Dolls, which also has Broadway in its sights.
Oh, that gets a bit...
And they're kind of facing off in about six or seven or eight categories, and I have no idea how it's going to go, but it'll generate some genuine tension on the night. One odd thing, Best Director is for kind of old guard male directors. It's as if kind of the younger generation, women, people of color haven't happened. I'm not dissing these nominees, who include people like Sam Mendes, Rupert Gould, Jamie Lloyd, Stephen Daldry, but what about the next generation?
Indeed. So is there has that been publicly acknowledged, or is this just something that people have noticed?
It's just something people have noticed.
And what can be done to change it? Because one imagined that a city like London would be able to sort this out pretty efficiently.
It's a tricky thing, because I am not for a second suggesting that these men don't deserve their nominations. Their work across all four shows is very strong. I think one thing that could be done might be to have five nominees rather than four, to sort of open the door a little bit to a next generation. So this isn't just sort of same old lineup. But I think The Motive in the Queue and Dear England are facing off against one another for Best Play. Both of those have New York in their sights. So actually, from a New York Times stroke international perspective, this is a very interesting Olivier Awards, because the ramifications for New York theater are quite considerable.
What could go over to New York then?
Well, Motive in the Queue, the play about Richard Burton and John Gielgud collaborating on Hamlet in 1964 on Broadway, is already earmarked for Broadway, because that's where it's set. So if it wins an Olivier Award, that helps a lot.
Matt Wolff, thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. It's Design Week in Sao Paulo. To tell us more, I'm joined from the Brazilian city by Monocle's senior correspondent Fernanda Augusto Pacheco. Bom dia, Fei.
Bom dia, Emma. Great to be here and great to be in Sao Paulo. As you rightly said, Design Week just started yesterday, and that's all the city can talk about.
And where are you? Tell us, describe a little bit your setting, sort of scene. Do a little scene setter for us, would you please?
I will. I had the pleasure to sleep this evening at a modernist building called Edifício Renata Sampaio Ferreira. This is an iconic building for the city of São Paulo. It's being designed by Oswaldo Arthur Bratke. Most people here know the building. So it's been recently retrofitted by Metro Architects. And it's a beautiful project because before I think it was kind of closed to the public, but now you can rent apartments here. There's even a restaurant on the third floor with a swimming pool as well. And it's a beautiful building. It's the perfect capsule of Brazilian modernism. There's a lot of breeze blocks around. And the connection with Design Week is that Design Week, for the first time, they'll have a tour of the historical buildings in São Paulo. And this will be a hub, exactly where I am now. So it's been, a pleasure being here in this building that I always wanted to visit, to be honest.
I mean, you do have to always ask when someone repurposes or revisits a very important and significant building, which was beautiful to begin with. Have they done a good job here?
They've done a great job. And I'm very glad because São Paulo is that kind of city where, they just kind of destroy a house and they build like a building with no connection to the history of the city. Perhaps it's not a city that is known to preserve its history. But the reality is, Emma, in the 50s and the 60s, you had so many brilliant buildings here in São Paulo. And I'm glad that more and more some architectural companies and construction companies, they are having this different thought. They want to protect those buildings because that's what Brazil is known for its modernism, which is not just Brazilian. It's São Paulo and Rio. And I'm seeing more and more, and I'm glad it's part of the DW, which is the name of the Design Week here in São Paulo. I had the pleasure to speak. I know we're playing on Saturday, my interview with Lauro Andrade. He's the founder of Design Week in São Paulo. And he's been telling me as well how the growth, the incredible growth of Design Week, it started just as kind of a place where you can have a cocktail and, share opinions with other architects and designers. But now it's a massive event all across the city of São Paulo.
And where does this place, São Paulo, a city which is famous for its design and for its architecture? I mean, you're sitting somewhere beautifully modernist, but you also have neo-Gothic cathedrals. You've got a church that goes back, a good couple of hundred years. You have skyscrapers from the 1920s. You have Oscar Niemeyer. You have São Paulo's just vivid, vivid skyline.
Yes, and I have to say, it's an underrated city. Unlike Rio, which, all the tourists love, I think there's so much to discover. And even the area I am now, which is downtown São Paulo, which I have to say suffered a lot during the pandemic. There's a lot of kind of social issues. I'm not denying those, but it's good that there are new places like this open to the public as well. And one interesting thing about Design Week, and I was talking to Lauro before, all this Brazilian design used to go to Salone del Mobile, which is happening in Milan next month, and then come to Brazil. But now it's the opposite. It's exhibited here first and then go to Salone. And I think that shows the seriousness and how much it's growing.
Let's talk a little bit about television. Formerly the company HBO Max is investing hard in Brazil.
Very much. And I'm kind of happy. Max is investing a lot of money. And I'm glad they want to compete with Globo, which is the largest broadcaster. They are the ones who produce all the beloved telenovelas. And they're taking a risk here because they have a big budget. They hired excellent talent, many of the actors that used to be on Globo. So it is a big, big investment. So the soap operas are not out yet, but they are in production. They're big, Emma. One example is, I very much look forward to see this one. It's called Beleza Fatal, or Fatal Beauty. It's a story about two families in three plastic surgery clinics. And one of the characters, her name is Lola, and she has this kind of empire of plastic surgery clinics called Lola Land. So it would talk about beauty and Brazilians' obsession with plastic surgery. There'll be some crime. So they know exactly what they're doing here. They're choosing themes that, Brazilians would care for. There will be a remake of Dona Beja, which is a soap opera from Globo in the 80s. But this Dona Beja was a character from the 19th century, a very liberated woman. She founded a brothel. She's kind of a historical character, very daring, the soap opera in the 80s. And I think they will continue that as well. So yeah, big investment. I look forward to see those.
Nothing more enticing than a Brazilian plastic surgery empire. Fernando Augusto Pacheco on the line from Sao Paulo. Thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to our producers too, Laura Kramer and Chris Chermack. Our researcher was George Ruskin. Our studio manager was Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday here in London, and The Globalist is back at the same time on Monday. I hope you can join me for that. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.